From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
This is Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors, and today we are joined at Naps Chat by our Executive Vice President, Ivan Butts. Now, Ivan, let's start here. We're 8.5 months since Congress first convened. We're probably no closer to a comprehensive, meaningful, constructive postal reform bill than we were probably at the beginning of the year. What do you think is attributable to this sort of inaction by the United States Congress?
Well, Bob, I think it's a few indicators that we can see and look at as to why we haven't been able to move the ball for postal reform nearly as well as we have in past years. Obviously, you can see the gridlock that continues to go on up here in Washington, D.C., between the House and the Senate and Democrats and Republicans. I also look back at that hearing that the House Committee on Government Oversight had, where Mr. Meadows was really challenging to the PMG on her failure to timely submit the 10-year plan to him as she had promised, and how that made him waver or caused him pause to making legislation for postal reform. And I even commented to you at that meeting. I thought that opened the door for maybe the support from that side of the aisle to kind of leave postal reform. And it opened the door for that, just that interaction between Representative Meadows and the PMG. And subsequently, we haven't seen a bill, although we've been told numerous times that bills were coming out, something was coming out, nothing has materialized as of yet. I think looking back to talking with you on yesterday, maybe that we might see something coming from Senator Carper.
There's some chatter going on that there are preliminary conversations among a number of senators about postal reform legislation, but there's no indication that the chairman of the committee with jurisdiction over the postal bill, that would be Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committees, has any interest in moving a postal bill before the House moves its version of a postal bill.
Absolutely. And Senator Johnson in the past has always said, although he has kind of yielded it to Senator Carper to come up with and deal with the postal reform issue, he's been clear about he would not move ahead of the Congress. And now we understand, as we have seen, that the Senate is rarely moving on any type of legislation at all. So, you know, again, it's a little disappointing for us this year that we weren't able to move the ball after having such a productive year last year in moving the ball forward with postal reform. However, we still have some, a lot of some bills out there, and we've got a lot of support through the resolutions that we have that have came out this year in support of postal service and in support of postal operations, like House Res 23, which the House gave the sense that the Postal Service should take all appropriate measures to ensure the continuation of door-to-door delivery. House Res 33, that the Post Office take all appropriate measures to remain the independent established, against privatization. I think one of the key ones, looking at finishing the year strong, and I want us to kind of keep focus on, is actually House Resolution 2382, and that was to repeal the retiree pre-funding. I think that is something that's still very significant and still very timely for us to try to work through and keep on the table.
Interestingly, as you referenced, there are a number of resolutions which are not binding. They just sort of sense of the House resolutions. However, H.R. 2382, which is actually a bill that would change the law, would repeal a provisional law that was passed back in 2006 as part of the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, which forced the Postal Service, unlike any other agency or corporation in the country, to pre-fund at 100% its retiree and future retiree obligations. Interestingly, Ivan, and this is attributable to the work of our members at NAPS as well as others in the postal community, that bill, H.R. 2382, currently has 249 co-sponsors and is bipartisan. There were 211 Democrats on that bill and 38 Republicans on the bill. A majority of the members of the House would be 218. So with 249, that is more than a majority of the House of Representatives. So as we've talked about this in the past, because comprehensive postal reform may not be achievable right now, at least between now and the end of the year, maybe we should go small ball and maybe take this bill up and basically get one of the most burdensome requirements on the Postal Service off the table once and for all.
Absolutely. And you're right. That is a credit to the work that, you know, our members are doing out there in the field at local events and the work we're doing up here in D.C. to educate lawmakers on this onerous burden that was placed on the Postal Service with the 2006 Postal Reform Act bill. This funding, pre-funding retiree benefits 75 years out at 100% is a burden no other agency has to bear, and it's accounted for virtually all the losses the post office has seen. I know the post office likes to talk about declines in first class volume and what they attribute to. But this burden of this pre-funding has unjustly weighed heavy on the Postal Service over these past years. And to repeal that would be a good thing. So, you know, looking forward to finish the year strong, absolutely. I think we need to look small ball and continue to push this bill forward to the finish line.
One of the new items that we included in the upcoming issue of the Postal Supervisors Magazine, which is going to come out in October, is a list of co-sponsors of those bills that we're keeping an eye on. Two of the bills that are of specific interest to our members is clearly H.R. 2382. And when I say bills, I'm saying actual legislation. In addition to the resolutions that are non-binding, is H.R. 2382, which is the pre-funding repeal, and also H.R. 597, which provides all EAS-level employees with the right to appeal adverse personnel actions to the Merit Systems Protection Board. And we list in the magazine who's co-sponsoring which bills. And members, it enables our members to go out and to communicate with their members of Congress if they haven't signed up for particularly H.R. 2382 and H.R. 597, in addition to the other bills that we've highlighted.
Absolutely. And first, let me speak about that tool that's coming out in this edition of the Postal Supervisor. I applaud you for putting that together. It was a tremendous help to me. Just yesterday, I got contacted by Jaime Elizondo out of Texas. He's setting up a meeting down there, actually a plant visit down there with the local congressman, and he wanted the economic data and then the bills that he had signed on. So it's going to be a great tool for you guys to hold on to and to use when you're meeting with your representatives to know what to thank them for signing on to and then what to encourage them to sign on to. And in mentioning Brother Jaime and our Texas NAPS family, our hearts and prayers go out to you as you deal with these floods, that the worst floods in history that you're dealing with right now. I pray that you all are safe and know that we're here for you. And we have our PERF, and then there's FEEA grants available for those who are in need. And so your NAPS representatives can get you that information if need be. But you are in our prayers.
And it's also important, in addition to keeping in mind all of our members and all postal employees who are going to be impacted by I guess Tropical Storm Imelda is what it's referred to out in Houston, is also that the Postal Service is one of the few entities out there that will be in an emergency situation, is where individuals can get help and where they could access important financial needs that they might have, because that's where any type of mail and communications necessarily would be sort of, they would receive when the phone lines are down, when their internet is down. The Postal Service is still there.
Mm-hmm. And that just goes to who we are as an agency over time. You know, the post office, and we heard this here talking with historians, how the post office used to be the place where, you know, communities came to gather. They came to gather at the post office to meet and talk about things, and that's where all the information's from. We know the history that the Postal Service is the one who created post roads for binding America together, and that's what we continue to do even in these disastrous situations. We continue to bind America and keep them together. So I applaud you guys for all that you do to make that happen as the supervisors and managers, supervisors, postmasters of this agency. You make that happen every day.
Also, slightly off topic but sort of on topic, is the financial condition of the Postal Service. As our members may or may not know, the Postal Service is now engaged in interest arbitration with the American Postal Workers Union, and will likely begin arbitration with the National Association of Letter Carriers, who they are currently in negotiation with. And they have every incentive to make the financial position of the Postal Service look as dire as possible in that negotiation. And Ivan, what impact does that type of messaging have on legislation, and particularly on the White House? Because the White House is sort of looking to sort of jumpstart its own task force recommendations, which could lead to the privatization of the Postal Service. So if the Postal Service starts promoting this financial apocalypse in order to posture itself in collective bargaining, how's that going to affect us with regard to the White House and regard to those in Congress who support privatization and to reduce benefits of postal employees?
Well, first, let me talk about, I really don't know much about what the craft unions are doing, going to interest arbitration and those things. But I do understand this firmly, that the arbitrators and those venues do not consider the post office financial condition as viable reasons for denying their members or denying those union members pay. Unlike what we deal with in our pay talk situation, where the Postal Service would try to rely solely on their financial condition to suppress managers' pay, and have done so for over 10 years. That being said, we know what we're facing with the task force and then the OMB report that came out in June, and now the president's task force and the privatization. So those are issues that we have been dealing with. Again, I tell our members, from the 70s, they've been trying to privatize the Postal Service. And I understand that. At the end of the day, we're an $86 billion company, right? We make $86 billion in revenue. So through everything that's going on, somebody would like a piece of that $86 billion. So we understand the initiatives and the desires to take off pieces of our Postal Service. But what we say is that, that will only weaken our country, not strengthen our country. That won't bind our country together, but really seem sense of untying it. Now, the president's task force wants us to look at the universal service obligation in a more proactive manner and decide, make a determination of who deserves or who needs a universal service, and then craft services for them. I'm of the position everyone needs universal postal service. Everyone needs universal service. That's the spirit of the Constitution when we were enacted, is that we would bind America, not some of America, but all of America. And that's what we continue to do, and that's what we're going to continue to fight to do, even in these times of talks of privatization, coming from actually the people that we vote into office to represent our needs.
Now, not to promote my column in the upcoming issue of the Postal Supervisors, but I do talk about a foreign experience with corporatization of a foreign postal service, and that's the Israel Postal Corporation, which sold off 40% of its value to the on the Israeli stock market. I should let everyone know, and they could read it in the column, that the Israeli Postal Corporation now delivers to home addresses only 2.5 days a week. Only 2.5 days a week. It sort of alternates days. So 1 week it'll be 2 days, the next week it'll be 3 days a week, and it doesn't deliver mail on the Sabbath, which is Saturday in Israel. Also, I should let people know out there, but when you talk about privatization or corporatization and that profit incentive and getting away from the universal service obligation, that a lot of deliverers in Israel are private licensees. They're not employees, governmental employees. And interestingly enough, a lot of the postal retail facilities are franchises, and the franchise owner determines what hours Correct. They are open. And that's in a country the size of the state of New Jersey. Now, if you apply that same model to a country the size of the United States, Katie, bar the doors.
You're absolutely right. And that's one of the things when we look at the countries that have privatized their postal systems, and which the Postal Service is raising as a standard. You look at the rates. The rates for mailing have skyrocketed. Their service has totally diminished. Their commitment to delivery, regular delivery of mail, has all but gone away. So we know our customers, they need their medicine, which is being shipped by mail. They need their medicine when they need it, not whenever it decides to come. They need our farmers in our heartlands. They need their seed when it comes time for planting season, and those things they depend on. Their circulars and their news, those things they need. Those are vital to the infrastructure of America, and that's what the Postal Service delivers, and that's what we need to keep delivering, and not try to privatize it and let them decide and let corporations decide who's worthy of receiving mail and who's not.
Now, Ivan, we've had time to review in some detail the final recommendations made by the Federal Conciliation and Mediation Services panel, independent panel. And we've also come to recognize that there are certain deficiencies in the 40-year-old law, which relates to the consultative process as it affects EAS employees. And the three areas that I think we've identified as being problematic are, number one, the timeliness of going to consultations, that we are held captive to the timing of the labor unions and the resolution of whatever their contract negotiations or arbitration are. We're also sort of dealt sort of at a disadvantage because of lack of transparency, that the Postal Service doesn't share data in a timely or at all with us prior to and during the consultative process. And finally, the outcome of a mediation panel as currently could be totally ignored by the Postal Service. So it's sort of unfair. So what are we looking at as we sort of discuss with Congress the deficiencies in the law, current law?
Well, I think you just really hit it. Those three areas are really what we're going to look at. When we feel that, the timeliness of starting our pay talks, where we're waiting until the largest union ratifies their contract, and then 45 days after that point, the post office comes to us with a proposal. That's really an unfair timeline, unfair burden for us to have to wait that long. I mean, granted, that pay package for the craft employee may change the SDA, but hey, the supervisory differential adjustment changes a few times a year anyway. So that alone is not a reason for us to hold off on starting negotiations on a EAS pay package. And by starting it 6 months earlier, maybe we can get to a quicker resolve on a pay package where we don't run into these issues where we're a year or 2 years after the expiration of our pay package, trying to go back and get a retroactive pay that's deserved and what we've seen in most cases not given by the agency. So, yeah, obviously giving information, you know, that's vital to any case, whether it's a DDF case or whatever you do, whatever you do. I mean, the ability to have information is important. And in these venues, you would think that, you know, that would be a mandate that the post office would be transparent in giving the data that's being requested. But we saw in this fact finding that that was a challenge also. So that's maybe something else we want to look at. And then ultimately, you know, when you look at going to a fact finding panel and the fact that this panel comes up with recommendations, they take the time, they work hard, they spend 2 days, and then they spend weeks sifting through all the data that we're given and come up with some recommendations that, you know, they feel are very sound. And in this instance, we feel they're very sound also. For the Postal Service to move forward in a way that reflects adherence to the law, and the Postal Service has that right to say thanks but no thanks. That's something that really needs to be addressed. So at the end of the day, your best foot forward is kind of it is hitting a wall. Right, that's there from the very beginning. So, you know, yeah, we definitely want to look at trying to change that piece of the statute that we could make that more binding, those decisions that come. If both parties sit down before a panel and pour out their decisions and ask this panel to make sound recommendations, then those sound recommendations need to be adhered to.
Now, let's move on to another topic, politics, which is that we're entering an election season right now, and members of Congress and the American public are starting to focus on the upcoming 2020 congressional and presidential elections. But we're going to focus on congressional elections. What we do here at NAPS in evaluating current members of Congress, incumbents, is we look at access. We look, you know, are they accessible to our members? What bills they co-sponsor, where they are, what committees they're on, and how they've positioned themselves on postal issues. Challengers to incumbents and members who are running in open seats becomes a much more tricky issue. And what we do is we prepare a candidate questionnaire. And so have a draft that we've already prepared. And so I'd like to just sort of briefly go through some of the issues that we're going to be using to evaluate members who want to be members of Congress. We're going to ask, for example, for their support of modification of the current law with regard to consultative process. Would they support changes to the consultative process for it to be fairer to EAS-level employees? And we've covered that a little bit, Ivan. But, you know, we're also going to be talking about to what extent they are committed to the universal service obligations, whether it be door delivery, six-day delivery, accessibility, and so forth. How important is that for us to determine who gets our support for election?
I think it's very important. It gives us a base on where candidates are, where candidates' views are, and how much they know currently about Postal Service. You know, we come up here in LTS every year, and then on a 2-year cycle, we come in up to educate the new members of Congress. So this kind of gives us a starting look at, you know, what level of understanding do they have of the Postal Service, what understanding do they have of the needs of America's Postal Service, and where their support is to that effect. So the questionnaires are always important, and that's why we develop them and get them out to legislators as they call and contact us about events they would like us to support, so we can understand and get an understanding of who they are and understanding where we are. We did tremendous last cycle. I know I've said this. We had over 92% efficiency rating in candidates that we supported winning their elections, and that was a great turnout. We're going to be looking for that kind of turnout once again. We got a big move on the Senate side, with, you know, some big names, big supporters coming up for re-election. We got Mark Warner and Dick Durbin, who are very, very big leaders on the Senate side that we're going to be looking at supporting, and people that we've supported in the past, Senator Markey, Senator Shaheen, Senator Booker, Reed, definitely Senator Peters, who is the ranking member on our committee. We certainly want to show tremendous support to him moving forward. And then, you know, then there are some toss-ups that we need to look at, too, on the Senate side and see if we can make some inroads. Doug Jones, Senator Jones out of Alabama, Senator Massally, Senator Gardner, and actually, you know, we would call her one of our champions, someone who really helped us with the 2006 postal reform bill, Senator Collins. So we, you know, these are some toss-up races that we want to look at, and we want to try to secure those over to the labor side. So yeah, we have a lot of work ahead of us. And you'll be seeing that roll out in the next few months, and then certainly we'll be ramping up in 2020, getting ready for November elections.
So, Ivan, that's about all the time we have for today. I want to wish everyone a wonderful week, and I just want to take notice that Ivan is here in his Philadelphia Eagles regalia.
Go Birds!
So, with that parting note, till next week.
I'm going to bend right down and write myself a letter and make believe.